Good morning. This is the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with
Scott Nelson.
And today is Wednesday, February 10th. This is episode one. Here we are, starting the podcast.
What do we do first?
Well, we've been having arguments and discussions that are at least interesting to us for a long time, so we might as well record it, right?
Yes. Our gift to the internet.
It remains to be seen if it's a gift, but sure. Here on the list here, we talk about what podcasts do we listen to. So what podcasts do you listen to, Scott?
Well, my oldest listening experience is probably the This Week in Tech podcast. That was my first foray into tech podcasts, I think. And I listened to a few other shows. Do you listen to anything on the Twit Network?
No.
They do a lot of shows. I listen to a couple of them. They do one where they talk about Google and cloud computing that I like. And then they have a weekly tech review. I listen to that. I'm kind of into like startup news. I listen to This Week in Startups. I listen to some of the shows on Relay FM, mostly about Apple products and software development, stuff like that. I listen to Accidental Tech Podcast. It's one of my favorites with lots of Apple review.
Nodding my head at the microphone does not imply that I'm agreeing with you, but yes.
You're agreeing. What about you? What are you listening to these days?
Almost none of that stuff.
What's the matter with you?
Exactly. That is a very good question. I was trolling through my podcast app on the iPhone, and I'm subscribed to The Economist Radio. I'm subscribed to Radical Personal Finance, the talk show with John Gruber. I listen to Science Friday from NPR, a podcast called Stuff You Missed in History Class, and America's Test Kitchen Radio. So apparently I choose to get all of my tech news in printed form, and with the exception of the talk show, and not get any of it through my headphones. So there you go.
So now I feel guilty. I'm kind of like the dilettante, I guess. I listen to the talk radio of podcasts where you listen to actual information.
Maybe. Maybe it's information. Maybe it isn't.
So then I was going to ask, is listening to other podcasts going to influence what we talk about and opinions on things? And it's sounding like for you it won't, and for me it might, because I'm listening to a lot of other people's opinions on, tech, on Apple, on software development, on things that I talk about. So it'll be interesting to see how I tend to adopt other people's opinions. You know, one time we had talking about Star Wars, and I've literally listened to hours of other people talking about Star Wars. So I think, that's probably changed my opinion on the movie in a lot of ways. And I don't know if I would end up regurgitating other people's opinions.
Well, it's, I'm kind of looking forward to doing a Star Wars episode in the future. I have read articles about Star Wars in the way that you have listened to podcasts. And clearly other people's views and commentary on it make me think about it in certain ways. So I want to go see it one more time, and then we should talk about it and try to synthesize what we've read and listened to with our own opinions into one coherent narrative.
I guess it's good there's no copyright on ideas about Star Wars. So it's not like, you're influenced by music. You write a song and has somebody else's riff, then they sue you for millions of dollars.
Well, it is Disney. They might find a way.
But whoever's idea I stole about Star Wars is not going to come back and sue me for it, I guess. So yeah. What I might try and do, if we're going to be recording and we're going to talk about a specific topic, I might refrain from listening to podcasts that week, or, refrain from trying to...
I think you should do the other thing. I think you should... If we're going to talk about a topic, you should be all in.
Synthesize other people's opinions.
You'll maybe make me learn something. That's always useful and hard to do, because sometimes I'm dense.
So the other thing I was going to ask you, which I don't know what the sponsorships are. Most of the podcasts I listen to have sponsorships, of products, which I'm kind of a sucker.
Yeah.
And when I hear someone I respect tell me about something, you know, that's great that I should buy, I tend to buy it. So I have a Casper mattress. I bought some Warby Parker glasses. I've tried, you know, I'm working on a website right now and I'm using Squarespace. A lot of the familiar names in podcast sponsorship I have tried out with mixed results, I think.
Do you buy these things unconsciously, or do you buy them because you decide you need a thing and then remember something that was mentioned to you in that space?
It's that I need a thing and a seed has been planted at some point in time that this is the way to obtain said thing. So I needed a mattress and I was like, well, I know somewhere I can get one delivered to my door.
So I, with the mattress, I did the same thing, but not from a podcast. One of the blogs I read, made a reference to having recently gotten a Tuft and Needle mattress and they really liked it. And it's again, one of these, you know, memory foam, compress it down and send it to your house, internet mattress retailers. And that's what I order. That's what I have. And I like it.
I guess I always like to claim that I'm immune to advertising. Like, I don't really buy things I see advertised on TV. Web advertising is completely pointless for me. It doesn't work on me. But maybe this is my kryptonite in advertising, is like native podcast ads.
I am very much affected by advertising. I find myself all the time with a bunch of stuff in my shopping cart at Amazon that is undoubtedly cool stuff that I've convinced myself that I need in some way. And then over the years, I've gotten better at kind of waking up with my hand hovering over the buy now button and saying, wait, why do I need something absurd like another set of kitchen knives or the 14th water bottle to go in my cupboard or some other crazy thing that I don't need?
Prime does not help with that. You do Prime.
I do Prime.
I've had to kind of try and fix that problem. Once I started using Prime, I'm much more likely to buy something because I know I can get it immediately. That used to be a deterrent. I'm going to have to wait a week to get this thing. Do I really need it? Do I really want to wait? You know,
do you ever worry about Prime? Like, I have this worry that while I understand Amazon's desire to have one account that gives you the world and all of the things that they're packing into a Prime membership, you know, the TV streaming and the Kindle lending library, I mean, all of that stuff. I bought Prime a long time ago when it was just for two-day shipping with no $25 minimum, and I worry, perhaps irrationally, that the more value that they pile into this $100 a year Prime membership, the less importance for Amazon that the shortened shipping time becomes. And that is the most important thing to me. Now, maybe that's an indictment of all of the rest of the services that they've baked into the Prime subscription don't have much value to me. And that's true, but I have this irrational worry that they're going to take the eye off the ball and I'm going to start getting stuff slower.
Have you had that happen? Have you noticed any shipping problems?
Have I noticed? No, but you used to get stuff. It was not uncommon to get stuff almost even before the 2 days had gone by.
Yeah.
And that never happens now.
No, I have noticed problem. You know, I've been doing Prime for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years now. And it used to be everything was UPS. You know, everything was on or before the date they said. Now, I don't know if they do this in your neighborhood. In my neighborhood, Amazon has been doing a lot more of like deferring things to the post office.
Yes.
So I've been getting more and more Amazon stuff in my post office box. And now the weakest link becomes the postman. And I have a lot of problems in my neighborhood with things getting put in the wrong boxes. I have like a big community mailbox with a key.
Yeah.
Things get put in the wrong boxes. You know, they'll not deliver something for some reason, or, you know, if it won't fit in the box, they'll knock on the door, but they won't leave it outside the doorstep like UPS does.
Right.
I have many more problems with the USPS delivery, and Amazon is doing more of that because I'm sure it's cheaper.
I have read, I don't know how true it is, but that I've read that Amazon shipping is chewing up a significant amount of capacity in the shippers, right? I mean, they're one of the largest shippers of things in the world. And so part of it is, you know, having multiple shippers is a way to play them off each other for cheaper rates. But part of it is just a raw capacity problem as well. Maybe they're a victim of their own success.
Could be. I think the conversion to USPS has caused them to change some packaging too. Like, I've had this problem now where a couple CDs I've bought have gotten broken because...
Oh yeah, we've talked about it. You almost have to order a CD with a book now.
Well, that's what your advice was. Never buy a CD unless it's along with something else, so it'll actually be in a box. And I've employed that technique now, and that, you know, never fails. As long as it comes in a box, it's fine. But they've moved to this packaging that it isn't even like a bubble wrap. It's just a thick cardboard. And then the CD is basically like vacuum sealed inside of the envelope. But both times I've received CDs like that in the mailbox. Well, first of all, so my mailman just like folds it up as tight as he can and like shoves it in my little teeny tiny mailbox. So for all I know, you know, it got broken right there at the point of delivery when it got shoved in the mailbox. But twice now I've had CDs broken delivered by the post office.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Why are you still getting physical CDs?
I don't know. I like CDs, but if the jewel case is cracked, does it really matter? I don't know. I mean, I feel like I bought something new and I paid the money for it like it was new, and the jewel case shouldn't be cracked.
Well, there's you can always, you know, put the piece of paper in a new jewel case.
Right? It's a principal thing. Like, I feel like I need to make it known to Amazon that they're doing a bad thing and they should stop it. And for every like broken CD they get delivered, I'm sure it's a tick mark in a column somewhere that says reevaluate this packaging decision. I hope it is.
Maybe. You would think it might be, but maybe that's optimistic.
First world problems.
Yeah. Speaking of first world problems, so Walt Malsberg had an article the other day about complaining about the relative quality of Apple software. So he is not the first person to make this argument, but I kind of agree with him.
I guess I feel like the argument has reached critical mass now. Like we were saying, you know, Marco Arment made that argument like a year ago now, and it, you know, there was some agreement, some disagreement. It seems like now finally everybody's on board. After Mossberg wrote his article, then, you know, there was an article in the LA Times. The headline was something like Apple, you know, Apple fans getting mad or something like this. I mean, so it's hit mainstream media.
Yeah. Do you think the software quality has changed significantly in the time that you've been using a Mac?
So this is where I maybe have a little bit different perspective, because I'm kind of a latecomer to Apple products. Like, I've had a MacBook just for a few years. I'm on my first iPhone. The iPhone 6 Plus is my first iPhone after 6 years of Android phones. So, you know, I haven't had a lot of time to see a change in quality. I do have quality complaints, but for me, it's mostly stuff that's kind of been there since the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I think my first Mac came with Snow Leopard on it. So I only know OS X like from that point forward.
Right. So my first Mac, I looked it up today. My first Mac was a 2002 titanium PowerBook G4. So that was the 15-inch screen with the 1 gigahertz CPU. It had the 60 gigabyte hard drive and the DVD burning SuperDrive. Is a very fancy machine. And that shipped with, if I recall correctly, macOS 10.2. So it was very early days. at the time I was using a Windows XP laptop extensively for my work. And the difference between Windows XP and macOS 10.2 was dramatic. The comment that everyone used to say, well, the Mac users at the time used to say, is, it just works. And that was the only real way you could describe it. It just worked. You could argue that the total surface area of the operating system was a lot smaller at the time. And it was. I'm sure if we had a macOS 10.2 system today, it would do almost nothing compared to what a modern macOS system does. But I very rarely encountered something that just plain didn't work, which you occasionally do now. You know, sometimes now things just don't work. Like sometimes your MacBook just doesn't connect or doesn't stay connected to a wireless access point, or you know, sometimes, you know, mail is just broken and sideways, or you know, iTunes is pretty easy to complain about. Yeah. But you know,
forget the low hanging fruit.
Yeah, that was a very rare thing, and it was everybody at the time was coming from, you know, the Windows monopoly, and so using something else was just a revelation, and it seemed so much better than it was. But it, you know, on the same hardware, when macOS 10.3 came out, it was faster. It would benchmark faster than macOS 10.2 on the same hardware. And then when macOS 10.4 came out, it operated at roughly the same benchmark speeds on the same hardware as 10.3. So in the early days of macOS, I recall it kept getting better every time, and it just worked. And now it almost works most of the time.
So you mentioned Wi-Fi issues. I have a lot of Wi-Fi issues with my current MacBook Pro. Like, I have to disable the radio frequently in order to get it to connect, particularly when it wakes up from sleeping. You know, the little Wi-Fi thing will just go up and down and up and down and up and down for the 60 seconds or whatever. And then I get the little exclamation point, like, it's just not going to happen.
Yep.
If I disconnect or turn off Wi-Fi, turn it back on, it will connect. And that's a problem that was bad, and it had gotten better. And now in the last, I don't know, month, it's gotten worse again. And I'm not sure if something changed, or the thing with Wi-Fi is you never know. Like, maybe it's my network, you know, yeah. Except I've had it happen on public networks. Like, I don't know.
It's not just a single access point.
It's not just a single access point.
Yeah.
My other real complaint is not so much. I mean, I feel like there's kind of two categories. There's like buggy software, and then there's like design decisions that have been made that cause stuff to not work or to not be usable. And that's my bigger complaint, I think, is it's not bugs, but it's things that I don't think are designed correctly.
So what's a good example?
For me, those problems right now mostly resolve around iCloud syncing. And yeah, it's like Apple is opposed to the use of like a refresh button or any sort of sync status type messages, which coming from mostly Google stuff, they're pretty good about letting you trigger a sync, trigger a refresh, give you some sort of indication about what's happening. I have this happen a lot. I use Photos. So I like Photos, but I'll take a photo on my phone, go directly to my computer, fire up Photos, and it's not there. And wait. And there's no way to see if that photo is going to show up, to see where that photo is. You know, like when you're using Dropbox, okay, and you load something in Dropbox on one location, and you go to another location, you can see the status. Like the metadata has, the sync is complete. So I can see that there's, you know, X number of files that are syncing, you know, this much data, this is what percentage I'm at.
There's an indicator in Finder for both Box and Dropbox you know, right on the icon, you know, big green check mark that says synced, or it's a yellow circle that says it is syncing. Yeah. I think that comes from Apple's internal view of itself that says it should just work. Mm. Why should you care about the syncing that's going on underneath? And that's part of, I think, where these complaints come from. People are willing to let Apple have that design decision if it just works. But it doesn't work often enough that it kind of drives you crazy. And they don't do a great job of helping you understand why it doesn't work. And you could understand it. I mean, you're a software developer. You understand all the difficulties of, you know, syncing across the internet, you know, over unreliable connections, and you have a good mental model of what's really happening underneath. But, you know, Joe, computer user, has no idea what any of that stuff means. And so Apple's view would be all of those buttons that Google and, you know, Dropbox give you do not serve the user because they don't know what they do. So why give them a button that may or may not solve their problem when they don't know when to do it? I like that philosophy. It means you're holding yourself to a higher standard.
Yeah.
Which means you have to do it. And I think that's where a lot of these complaints come from. Apple holds itself to a higher standard. It makes design decisions as a consequence of that. And then sometimes they fail to live up to that standard that they've set for themselves.
I had the same experience just last night in Notes. I had heard, you know, that there have been a lot of changes to Notes. I haven't been a heavy Notes user in the past. So I was like, I'm going to...
Apple's Notes. Not Lotus Notes. But Apple's Notes.
Right? Apple's Notes. Yeah. Oh, man. Lotus Notes. Notes. So I was like, for our podcast notes, you know, I was going to type them up in Notes on my Mac, and then they were going to sync to my phone because that's, you know, what should happen.
Exactly.
And I typed them up on my Mac, and they did not sync to my phone. And I didn't have it. I actually had to go in and configure my iCloud account, and I had to tick the Notes tick box. Like, that wasn't checked, so it was never going to sync.
Right.
So I got that checked, and then I moved the note to the iCloud account, you know, in Notes. Doesn't sync. Wait. I go to the phone and, like, create a test note on the phone, see can I get it to sync the other direction. Doesn't sync. I log into iCloud on the web to see, you know, if I can see the notes from both places. I mean, I spent, I don't know, a long time working on this. Never got it to work. So finally, go to the Apple forums. I think what's going on is I think they made major improvements to Notes on iOS, and now it's no longer compatible with Yosemite. I'm running Yosemite, and I don't think it's going to sync until I upgrade to LCAP.
Yeah, but again, you have
that's
no indication
problematic,
of
right?
why that is.
Yeah.
Right? A friend of mine, a competent computer user, had problems with Notes a couple weeks ago, and he could not get them to sync between his phone and his iPad, and he checked all of the settings and he couldn't figure out why it was working or why it wasn't working. And so I had him give me his phone, and I was messing with it for a while, and eventually I determined his phone was out of space, right? The notes were on the iPad, but they were not syncing to his phone. But he had set his phone to just fill all of his free space with music out of his iTunes library. And so it had done that. And so there was, you know, just a few megabytes free after it was done filling it up with music. And then just the act of using his phone, you know, Facebook caching or whatever, the phone was completely full. And it was still operating apparently normally. But of course, it wasn't syncing because there was no space on the phone's file system to write the notes. And if you dig way deep into the diagnostics and usage and look at all of the exceptions that were happening, I could actually find those exceptions. Like, you could see the note syncing process starting up and it keeling over and dying. And you could say, oh, you know, it had some error that kind of looks like maybe it was having a file system problem, which is what led me in the first place to go look and see, is there any free space? And of course there wasn't, but no regular person,
not even
a fairly competent iPhone user is ever going to figure that out, right?
And I would say the Notes app, I mean, any app, any native app that uses data and doesn't have anywhere to put it, needs to pop up a message that says, hey, you're out of space. Fix it.
It shouldn't be the app. The phone should say,
Yeah, nothing's going to work. Figure it out.
You're out of space, right? You need to do something about it. And that's not the only person that I've seen have a phone that's full and have things happen that they don't understand, right?
I mean, that's something that happens when you're running like a Linux box and you don't have any file monitoring and all of a sudden nothing's working and, oh, the hard drive's full, no more file descriptors.
Yeah, there's 8 bytes free on the disk. It's like, oh man, how did I get into this situation?
Yeah, I just wouldn't think on, the most user-friendly phone in the universe that you would have to worry about like silent hard disk full failures. I mean,
yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, this is why part of my success as an Apple user is, as a longtime Apple user, I think I have a good feel for what's important and what isn't important. So, my phone is the 128 gigabyte model because you can't expand it. You can't expand the file system with a SD card like you can on Android. And things go weird if you run out of space. You have a better Apple experience if your internal storage is larger. And you don't have to worry about where things are stored, right?
Well, then it's sure a good thing they don't sell anybody a 16 gig phone.
I know. Can you imagine? You pay all of this money for a premium device and you get some, crappy 16 gig phone.
That's absurd.
Yeah. Who would do that?
So to wrap up this topic, what are they going to fix it? What's going to happen? Are they going to heed Mossberg?
All of the commentary I have read about the various point releases for El Capitan are that it's all about under the hood fixes, which is all that they can do, right? Just keep fixing, and hope that you get enough stuff. I think so, right? I don't think they're going to let macOS die on the vine. It's entirely possible, though, that they only feel compelled to be just slightly better than Windows, which I think they are. And for most people, most people's interaction with Apple these days is iOS. Right? The next billion Apple users are going to be iOS users, not necessarily macOS users. So from a corporate standpoint, I think it makes sense for them to concentrate on iOS. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, ultimately, they want you to be more into the ecosystem, right? Don't they want all those iOS customers, all those iPhone customers to buy a Mac and to buy an Apple Watch and to buy an Apple TV? And it's to their advantage for you to be all in on Apple. So to just focus on iOS, I don't think doesn't fix the whole personal ecosystem problem.
It's not clear to me that the next billion computer users on planet Earth are ever going to have a need for a traditional computer as we think of it. Right? The average, Chinese or Indian individual is probably never going to own a Mac Pro, is very unlikely to own an iMac. Maybe they'll own a laptop, but as iOS and mobile devices become more capable, the need for these more traditional devices becomes less and less. I think we'll know when that transition has completely happened, when you can then start developing iOS apps on iOS. I think we're a ways from that, but maybe. All right, enough about that. Let's talk about the next thing. Let's talk about your new fancy watch.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I am rocking a Garmin Vivo Active. After having a Pebble Time for almost a year now, I was getting upset with some deficiencies in that particular watch, and so now I am trying a Vivo Active. I've been wearing it for 3 days now.
I think it's a better looking watch than the Pebble was.
Yeah. I like the look to it. It's a little bigger. It has the flat glass monolithic face to it, which I like. My key reason for moving away from the Pebble is I want a multi-purpose watch to use for fitness and for just day to day. And the Pebble does not have GPS in the watch. It does not communicate with like a Bluetooth heart rate monitor from the watch directly. So the phone has to be present for everything. And when I'm jogging, like I've tried armband, part of the problem there, I guess, is that I have a 6 Plus.
Yeah, big phone.
Big phone.
Harder to exercise with a big phone.
I tried an armband. I tried a waist, you know, like a fanny pack essentially for carrying your phone around. It's, don't want it. I don't want to take my phone on a jog. I just don't want to. So for me, it's essential to have GPS and Bluetooth heart rate monitoring or some sort of chest strap heart rate monitoring in the watch, which this one does.
Now, you prefer the chest strap over the thing on your wrist?
Yeah, this doesn't have the wrist monitoring. I think that's interesting, like the passive heart rate stuff, but that does not work for exercise. For me, it doesn't. Like my heart rate gets pretty high, and I like to have accurate heart rate data.
Yeah.
Because that actually, I mean, I use that on the fly to, you know, alter my pace or do intervals or whatever. And the wrist stuff just doesn't.
So fundamentally, though, you find a lot of value in the data, the health data garnered from the act of exercising, right?
Yeah. I don't know if I find I value is probably a...
Is it motivator?
Interpretive problem. Yeah, I think it's fun. I am more likely to exercise if there's going to be data to look at when I'm done. I do use it sometimes for interval training to see progress, right? How fast does your heart rate recovery happen? You know, what's the improvement there? I don't know what value there is, but it is a motivator. The more technology that's involved in my exercise, the more likely I am to do it.
You're not the only person I know that is that way. You know, a lot of people have a Fitbit now. You know, corporations are handing them out as part of their health insurance policies. And so a lot of my friends have Fitbits, and the, you know, keeping track of the step count, just having that number makes them want to make that number bigger. It's a strange motivator for them, but they like it and it's making good things for them. I think I would like all of that data, but I do not see any one device that's going to collect all of that data, right? Your watch has GPS in the watch, but it doesn't have a heart rate monitor, so you wear a strap. Well, that's probably fine when you're, you know, running or swimming, but it's...
you're not going to wear it all day, every day, right?
No, what a pain in the butt, right? In the, you know, something like an Apple Watch doesn't do a great job necessarily of heart rate monitoring, right? This is kind of a common complaint. And I, even as well built as the Apple Watch is, I am not personally particularly fond of square watches. So that, you know, the Apple Watch is kind of a non-starter for me because of its squareness, and the same for your your Garmin or your Pebble. You know, all of them are dictated by the screen, the watch face, right? That which is fundamentally true of watches, right? The shape of a watch is almost always dictated by its watch face. But all of my watches are round. And I've got, you know, 7 watches or something like that, right? All of them are round. None of them our smartwatch. And I guess I've always contended, you know, smartwatches will have really made it around the corner as soon as, you know, Rolex is up on stage somewhere and says, here is a smartwatch.
So this watch, as opposed to the Pebble, like the Pebble, I didn't wear it every minute of every day, because I was mainly just relying on it for notifications.
Yep.
So I would generally wear it when I left the house.
Right.
Sometimes, depending on what I was wearing, where I was going, I'd wear a mechanical watch. This, the idea is you're wearing it every minute of every day. It's tracking your steps, you know, to figure your calories. It's tracking your sleep. It has much longer battery life. The Pebble, you know, I had to charge a little more frequently. This is supposed to last for a couple of weeks.
Right.
I mean, I've gone 3 days and I'm still at 87% battery, so.
Does that track your sleeping habits?
Yes. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I think, you know, how you, if you think that you have a watch that you want to have on your person at all time, then it becomes the one and only watch, right? I mean, if I want to take this off because I want to wear a mechanical watch when I go somewhere tonight, I don't have my steps, you know, for the 2 hours that I'm out. Right. Well, like you said before, someone who's, you know, into the data and I want everything recorded and, you know, then it's like I'm tied to this watch permanently.
Right. The thing of it is, as interested as I am in the data, I'm not tied to getting the data from the watch. Right. The health data from a watch fills, you know, some Dick Tracy fantasy about what a wristwatch can be, but I don't know that it's necessarily the right answer. I mean, it's the answer we have now, right?
Right. I mean, you can wear your traditional watch and then you get your Fitbit, you know, clipped to your belt or whatever.
Yep.
But I mean, that is not doing GPS. That's, I mean, you can't, if you're going for a jog and you want to glance at your heart rate, like, are you going to pull your Fitbit out of your pocket, you know, and peek at its little teeny tiny digital screen? Like, I don't know. Maybe you take your phone. Maybe you carry your phone with you if you're not opposed to that.
So a friend of mine who wears a traditional watch has a Fitbit, the wristband Fitbit, but it is not the one with the display. It's just the one that just fits over the wrist. It's pretty small. It's pretty unobtrusive. And all of the data goes to the phone. But, of course, it goes to the phone whenever it's near the phone. It doesn't have to be, you know, it can record the data on the Fitbit and then sync it to the phone at a later date. That might be a way to go forward. Maybe, you know, you end up with some sort of, you know, medallion you wear on a necklace, right? That kind of, you know, magically is positioned above your heart. I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know that health data has to come from a watch, though. Maybe it will.
So we'll see. So far, so good. My one complaint so far is the notifications are a little wonky on this. That's one thing about the Pebble. The notifications were just rock solid. Always there. Like, I would feel my phone vibrate in my pocket. By the time I looked at my watch, the notification was there, you know? So I'm kind of trained to that habit. This, the notifications are, there's a little delay. Sometimes they don't show up. I mean, I think they're supposed to. I think, you know, enter Bluetooth. There's some sort of...
could be a power-saving thing. Who knows?
So I might have to dig into that.
Is there a new firmware for that watch?
Yeah, it's updated twice since I got it.
You've had it less than a week.
Yeah, well, I won't go into that whole saga, but I had it sitting on my counter charging for a couple days before I used it because Garmin...
oh, that's
was
right.
Down.
Garmin was
all
down.
Of Garmin was down the day I wanted to set up this watch, and it just, like, everything was fail. And then I...
yeah, this is the Internet of Things.
Yeah. That's just bad luck. I mean...
yeah.
So I won't fault on that. Like, I haven't had problems since Garmin got their stuff together this weekend, so...
if you think Apple can't do online services, what makes you think
Garmin
can do them in a reliable way?
So this still isn't my perfect watch because what it's missing is music. That's the one thing. So now when I'm jogging, I have an iPod Shuffle I kick it old school.
Oh.
That I hook to my headphones, you know? Yep.
Does the iPod Shuffle have Bluetooth in it?
No. So I have to use...
A wire.
Wired headphones. So what I do is I have ones that wrap around the back of my head, and then I just clip the Shuffle on it. It's like a hard band, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, and then with the Shuffle, okay, so I can't listen to Apple Music because you can't download Apple Music tracks to an iPod Shuffle because it doesn't have the DRM.
Right.
Nonsense. So I'm back to, well, if I want Apple Music, I have to take my iPhone with me. So that's where Apple Watch, from what I understand, you can put some tracks, I don't know how many or how much space or whatever, but you can put some tracks on the Apple Watch. Is that true? Can you listen to music on your watch without the phone present?
I don't know. That's an interesting research topic.
So that's something that, you know, and there are some watches that have storage for music, but you can't get everything right now. It's like, I can't get everything.
Right. I wonder if there's a market for some sort of iPhone companion. Like something in the, the iPod mini size, like something that's small and has a tiny bit of storage, but it's just a companion to the iPhone, right? Like it doesn't necessarily run all the apps, but would be a place to store your music, a place to store podcasts. It could do, you know, Bluetooth and maybe GPS and the things that you need your phone to do right now as a companion to the Apple Watch, but is small in the way an iPod Shuffle is small.
I mean, I think the answer is the phone is supposed to do that itself, right? That's the idea. Why do you need a middleman? You know, more stuff will go from the phone to the watch.
As you stated, the 6 Plus is too big.
Yeah. Right? Oh, sorry. I mean, I think the watch is going to do all that, right? You're going to get more and more stuff on the watch until now I can have the watch away from the phone and have it be functional.
Maybe. Whatever the next Apple Watch hardware is, it will be interesting to see if that's true.
Oh, okay. So line in the sand. As of today, will you ever own an Apple Watch? What's the over-under? Like,
I think, you know, I'm not that old. So over the rest of the remaining years of my life, I'd have to say probably. Will it be this current gen hardware? No, never. Will it be the next gen hardware? Probably not. Probably not. But we'll see.
Yeah.
I'll never say never. I like watches too much to say, no, I'll never have one.
I'm kind of torn. I mean, I like the idea of it. I'd like to have one, but now as I get used to having features that aren't in the Apple Watch, I don't want to go back. So I'm sure after I've had this for a month, I'll never want to have another watch that doesn't have built-in GPS. Will the Apple Watch 2 have GPS? I don't know. You know, I don't think Apple has a lot of incentive. I want the watch to be fully functional without the phone. I don't know if Apple wants the same thing. I mean, I think they want you to have your phone in your pocket at all times.
I think the tethered to the phone is just a design compromise to allow the watch to do the things that the watch can do today with the acceptable level of battery life and performance. That'll change over time as, you know, the power budget for the processor and the screen become less and less, and you can afford to have additional radios in there. Right? I think that'll change. So certainly it's a moving target. So we've been talking about the watches and the what they do for your fitness. Let's talk about your fitness. Why?
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. So how is the watch helping you? What is the fitness tracking doing for your fitness? Do you have a goal? Are you using it to set goals?
Yeah. I'm more using it to keep on track, to work out every day, right? I like having streaks going, right? Like I've done some sort of exercise every day. I do my food logging on my phone. I have a Wiving scale that reports my weight every day. For me, consistency is what keeps me in, you know, healthy. It's like when I stop working out for a day and then another day, and then pretty soon it's a week. And I think the tech keeps me doing things consistently.
Yeah.
Because I have that data to look at, and I have the graph to look at, and I see where I missed a day. That's what I've been doing, more tracking, just like, you know, how many minutes per day of exercise, the step counting, stuff like that, to just stress consistency.
So I don't use a fitness watch. And I don't work out every day. I have found my workouts are better if I have the occasional day off. Like today is going to be a day off from working out for me, right? I ran on Sunday. I had a regular, you know, strength training workout on Monday. I went and I ran on Tuesday. I can kind of tell my body is going to be happier if I take a day off. But I know by Thursday, I'll be ready to go work out again. For me, the motivation is the, you know, the two fitness goals I have right now, which is to do a pull-up unassisted, which I'm getting closer, right? And to run farther and run faster. You know, my run on Tuesday was a personal best for me, but it's not as fast or as long as I want it to be. So that's enough for me. Keeping track of a step count or, you know, heart rate recovery time or whatever these other things that you could track, I think they would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're not what's causing me to get into the gym, right? Stepping on my non-connected scale every morning and looking at that number, that's what makes me go to the gym and choose not to have a donut for breakfast, right?
But see, then you don't get coddled by your tech. So I got a text or a notification this morning, you're at a new all-time low weight. And then yesterday I crossed my 10,000 steps. Fireworks. There were fireworks on my Vivo Active. Like, you don't know the reinforcement you could be getting.
So whenever I see that stuff, all I can see is a bunch of like nerdy, lanky kids in Silicon Valley deciding that that would be awesome because you met another goal, right? Like, I feel like nobody in the Midwest would ever design software that put fireworks on your smartwatch, right? They would just say, good job, or keep running, fat ass. I mean, that's what they would say. And then if they were on the East Coast, they would say, what, am I supposed to be impressed by that? And that, you know. So maybe it's just that I don't buy into the Silicon Valley culture of everybody's awesome.
Maybe. Like I said, I feel it just helps me stay on top of things.
And that's great. It's the Fitbit has turned my girlfriend into a step count fiend, right? It's 10,000 steps a day, no matter what.
I need my steps.
Which is fine. If that's what motivates her, then I'm happy for it, right?
So. I don't really have any long-term goals right now. I'm trying to lose weight. That's the focus. Get stronger. I'm going to do a triathlon in June, a sprint triathlon. So,
Sprint triathlon, what is that?
It's basically just like a short course. So, I mean, the swim will be like I don't know, a few hundred yards. The bike will be like 10 or 12 miles, and the run will be a 5K.
Ah.
So, I mean, the person who wins it, it'll take them less than an hour to complete it kind of deal. It's just like a shorter course.
How long do you think it'll take you?
Take me?
Yeah.
Well, when I've done these in the past, like I haven't done one for a few years, but I mean, hour and a half, hour 40 minutes.
Do you have a goal time?
No, like...
Completing it is...
Completing it. So in the past, when I was doing triathlons, I would do the same one every year so then I could see from year to year.
Yep.
You know, because it's the exact same course. That's the thing. All these different triathlons, the lengths are different. So you can't really compare them to each other. And they're harder. You know, one might have a hilly bike course. You know, one might sure. not. So it's kind of apples to oranges. So you pretty much have to do the same race.
Yep.
In subsequent years to compare times. So this June... We'll just be finish it.
Okay.
So I
think I've mentioned you before. A friend of mine is suggesting that I run a 5K. He's like, man, you're putting the miles in on the treadmill. You ought to run a 5K sometime this summer. I'm still on the fence about that.
Don't commit.
I'm not committed, but I keep thinking about it, and I keep getting slightly more comfortable at the prospect of it.
Yeah. I am a believer in the training for something mentality, like having some goal set, some race I'm going to do, something I want to achieve. But I would argue your goal of doing a pull-up is training for something.
Yeah.
Right? And then once you get that pull-up, what's the next thing you're going to train for?
Two pull-ups.
Right. Well, we could probably get more creative than that.
Probably, but... I'm closer. I'm going to have a... We're going to do what do they call it? Like a max out session, you know, like what can you do? The last time we did this a few months ago, I got to only 48 pounds of assistance, right? You know, the pull-up machine is 120 pounds maximum assistance, right? And I could still do a pull-up with only 48 pounds of assistance, but in my workout routine on Monday, I was doing pull-ups just as part of the routine at only 48 pounds of assistance. So
are you tracking that somewhere, or is that just off the top of your head? You got to track that stuff.
Well, you know, first world problems, right? I pay for a personal trainer who helps me do all that
stuff. Does he track it for you? He's like your fitness secretary.
He is my fitness secretary. He writes all of these things down on a little sheet of paper, right? And he helps, you know, design the workouts, you know, and he's always referring back. He's like, oh, you know, the last time we did this, you did, you know, 10 of these at 30 pounds and da 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 da. So today we're going to do whatever we're going to do. So maybe I'm too old school, right? As opposed to spending hundreds of dollars on a new fitness watch every 3 months, I have my guy, right? And he makes me lift heavy things.
Henceforth, I will refer to him as your executive fitness assistant.
Hey, why not? I'm worth it. Yeah. So, what else we want to talk about? Man, we're coming up on almost an hour.
Should we wind it down?
Sure. What are we gonna watch? What are you watching? I know you just finished reading the first.
Yes, I finished the first Expanse book, which I know you've also read because I borrowed it from you.
Yeah. So now you're gonna watch the show.
Yeah, I'm gonna watch the show on Sci-Fi, see what I think, and then maybe be interested to see how they... It seems like it's going to be very ambitious to make this show. That's my initial assessment, so we'll see.
I think the linear narrative storytelling that we do in TV shows now allows for really ambitious stories to be told in a way that they cannot be told in a movie. So I feel like this is the right place to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to get the interesting thing now. So I intentionally wanted to read this book before I watched the series because I like to not have characters, you know, pictures of characters and settings and stuff
right
decided for me. But now it's that interesting thing that I'll get to see, you know, I have a picture, a mental picture now for every character. And what did the casting director think? You know, and right. It's going to be vastly different than what I saw in my head. So,
well, you've read the book first, so now you can legitimately say after you watch it, you can, you know, be derisive of it and say, "Duh, the book was better."
Yeah,
I mean, now you've set yourself up right. to have the out, right?
I mean, that's just kind of like the default position, right? It's like there's a 98% chance the book was going to be better than the movie / TV show.
Maybe.
We'll see.
When the Bourne movies came out, right, with Matt Damon, I really enjoyed them. And so then I went and I sought out the novels they came from, the Robert Ludlum novels. And I read them, and they weren't better. I liked the movies better.
Right? Okay.
And part of that, I think, is...
Sometimes it's what you did first, right? Like...
Maybe those novels are a little bit older. I mean, they're, you know, popular fiction, but they were set, I want to say, in the 80s. And so, you know, the subject matter of the novels was changed in the movies to be more relevant to the time when the movies came out. So it could just be, you know, I didn't need any more 80s in the stories, right? The character was interesting, which is why the movies are interesting. But that was an instance where I did not like the book better than the movie.
Interesting. I'm watching the new X-Files show. I was a huge X-Files fan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. It's fun. I like it because I'm a fan. I don't know that it's great. There were 4 episodes into like a 6 episode.
Yeah. The report I get is it's all over the map.
It is. Like, the first 2 episodes were very tight and kind of following a, you know, trajectory. And then the 3rd episode was just, like, completely bizarre. And I haven't watched the 4th one yet, so...
I wonder, were they all the same writer, or was there a different director for everyone? Like, I wonder what...
I'll have to look. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But this, like, short 6-episode kind of TV season-lit, if that's a word, right... It's kind of a thing. Like, the Agent Carter show is a 6-episode chunk. And I really liked Agent Carter. I don't know if you've watched.
I haven't. It's on my list.
Yeah.
That's kind of the British model, isn't it? Like, they tend to have, they call them series.
Yeah.
But they're more limited episode series. And then, you know, they may or may not have one every year or, you know, less than a year. And they're just kind of treated more as like modular.
Right. I think they work for certain kinds of stories. Like, I thought that the story that they told in Agent Carter was an acceptable kind of story. Like, it felt, you know, the 6 episodes felt enough to me to tell that story. I would not have wanted to watch, say, Battlestar Galactica 6 episodes
at a time
ago, right? Yeah. Like, not that there weren't several episodes in there that you could just get rid of and... the series would still be fine, but it seems like a bigger story to me than
right.
6 episodes ago.
What do you got going on that you're watching, reading, doing this week?
So we are about to finish Continuum. So I have been doing some preparatory work to try to get the next couple of Kubrick movies available. I want us to continue down our watching all of the Kubrick movies from the beginning to the end. So the next on the list will be Fear and Desire, which I've actually watched. I don't know if you've watched that at all. And then Killer's Kiss is the one after that. So Fear and Desire is... Kubrick was not happy with it. And I can see why, having watched it, but I think it's interesting from the perspective of trying to understand you know, him and his movies. I have not seen Killer's Kiss, but it's supposedly a little better. So I'm kind of looking forward to that when we finish Continuum. What about you? Are you looking forward to this Kubrick stuff, or am I just dragging you through the mud with it?
No, I am. So, yeah, we've watched a couple of Kubrick's early stuff. Is interesting. It's very different. It's not a movie that I... So far, the couple we've watched, I would not recommend anyone else should watch, but...
They're just for people trying to get a whole sense of the thing.
Yes, and, I mean, they had... We
watched the Seafarers thing, right?
Right.
Which had that one, like, tracking... camera shot,
right,
which was interesting, but as a subject it was not interesting at all. But hey, everybody has to make money, right? And that's clearly what that was for.
So yes, I like watching interesting movies. I don't know if any of Kubrick's movies I will recommend to other people. Yeah. Without certain caveats.
On a more modern note, I really want to go see Hail Caesar. Right? The previews for this movie just make me laugh. In the way that not all Coen brother films do, but I think this one will be really funny.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think there's interesting diversity in their movies. Mm. They don't make the same movie every time.
Yeah.
This looks like one of the funnier off-the-wall type films.
The idea of George Clooney is kind of this, like, clueless guy. Really, you know, he always plays these calm and cool and in-charge characters in all of his movies. And that he might not be that, I think, really is interesting to me.
What was the other... It's a Coen Brothers movie, isn't it? Where he was the crazy, like, I can't think of it.
Crazy what?
The one where he was like had escaped from...
Old Brother or Arthur.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That one. Yeah. That's a Coen Brothers film, right? Yeah. And he was just like a crazy, off-the-wall, neurotic character in that.
Yeah.
They must bring it out of him, or in him.
Maybe it's his natural state. And he has to be coached all the time how to be his Ocean's 11 character. I don't know.
Everything else is an act. This is like true Clooney.
Maybe.
You might have hit on something there.
A true Clooney. That could be almost some sort of measurement for something. Is that a true Clooney or not? I did the full Clooney. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week's episode. I had a good time. Let's do this next week.
I'll think about it.